Today's date is December the 2nd, 2015. My name is Jonathan Gerland. I'm with Mr. John Powers. We're at the History Center in Diboll, and we're going to do an oral history today. And Mr. Powers, just you were born in Fastrell, is that correct?
Born in Fastrell, March 29th, 1926.
1926.
That's one of my birthdays, and I'll tell you later on when I get in the military, I lied about my age, and I say I put my age at December 3rd, 1925, but that's all right, too.
Okay. So tell me about Fastrell. Born in 1926, I think the camp had been there just a few years.
1922, okay. Moved there. I'm not sure who the first child was born.
What were some of your earliest memories?
My earliest memories of Fastrell are just all beautiful, just indescribable. It was such a town that everybody loved everybody. If anyone had a problem, I don't care what it was, everybody come see what it was. It went on, and I was a youngster there, grew up. And my grandparents, John Richard White and Rose Cox, raised me.
Grandparents, okay.
My grandparents and I. Jonathan, I've still to find out why that they raised me. My sister said right after I was born, well, then mother had twins, and John Faye and Little Faye, and they died a week apart with pneumonia. And she thinks that Ma White and my aunt, Alma McMahon, they were instrumental in me staying with Ma White and Pa White and, you know, to help Mother. And it just went from there. But I stayed with my parents just a little small bit. But they raised me up, and my...
Your grandparents lived at Fastrell.
They moved away. They lived there for a while, but they moved away.
Okay.
And
did your dad work for Southern Pine?
Well, he worked for Southern Pine for a while, and then he and my granddad, they went in business for themselves and borrowed a bunch of money from a bank at Alto and went into the lumber business. Well, the lumber business did good there for a while. And then the Depression area hit along, and so they lost everything they had. They had a bunch of people working for them, but, you know, it's a situation they just couldn't go it. So then Daddy, he came back, and my granddad started working for Temple.
And okay. But you lived at Fastrell?
I lived at Fastrell all of that time. That time, sure did.
Well, talk about it. Well, what did your grandfather do before he got
He was an engineer for TSE Railroad.
Okay, locomotive engineer?
They had an accident, and he was injured. And I guess that Temple just, you know, kind of kept him as a, I don't know where they got the money from, but later, see, I knew they had enough to survive on. And Paul White, he took care of the engines that afternoon, you know, because they run the train from Diboll to Fastrell every day. And Paul White, then he took care of the trains.
Saying Paul, like P-A-W, or Paul?
Yes, P-A, Paul White, okay.
But what was his first name?
John.
John White.
I was named after him, exactly.
Okay.
And I don't particularly like the Richard end of it, but but everyone that's from Fastrell, when they call the house and the mother answers the phone, they want to talk to John Richard, but someone from Fastrell. But we all went by double name.
Yeah.
Yeah, just I guess that was typical in those days.
Yes, sir.
They raised me up, and Ma White was a very, very religious person. We'd come to Diboll every now and then, and, you know, on the train.
You would ride the train.
We'd ride the train. Okay. Boy, that was a big deal, too.
Was it on Saturdays or Sundays?
No, during the week. And we go, and Paul knew all the engineers and so forth. So we'd go with Mr. Hill and the other engineers down there. See, we'd visit all of them.
Would you ride in the caboose or car or the locomotive?
We probably in the caboose, I'm going to guess.
Okay.
But, you know, thinking back, I can see right down that track. So I might have been up there in a train. I'm not sure. I don't remember.
You don't remember. Okay. Do you have any memories of being around steam engines and things as a child?
No, that was the only one.
Okay.
That's the only one.
Okay.
When we got to Die Ball, though, well, I remember just so pleasant. Miss Hill made the first fruitcake I ever had, fruit salad. But she put everything as you could think of in that salad. I mean, just you name it, and it was so delicious. And I still remember that. I'm not going to tell you how old I am. I can still remember that salad. But we'd also go to Fastrell. I mean, go to Die Ball. And I'm not sure whether my grandmother was apostolic church, but she went to every church she could go to. But we would go at their little old churches down at Die Ball. They put limbs and whatnot, kind of made an arbor. Brush arbor, yeah. And they had none of that. But on up through the years, I hunted and fished lots. And Aunt Gertie White, her name was Gertrude Waltman before she married my granddad's brother. His name was Lee, Uncle Lee White. And Robert E. Lee was his name. And I don't know why, but boy, they was particular what they named those people then. But Uncle Lee and Aunt Pauline, Aunt Gertie, they had three kiddos. And I think y'all have some information from one of them, or two of them, rather. And Eula Clark and Edith, and they had a boy named R.L. But we were so close in that family. It's just unbelievable how close we were. Had a hotel there, and I remember that as a little bitty boy, big old hotel, two-story. And I think the lady's name was Vina Wells.
Vina Wells, huh?
And she was the wife of Richie Wells. And Richie, he was one of our superintendents or bosses there.
Yeah.
Run that deal. But they ran that. And they tell me that they had as high as 600 people there. But when I was growing up, that area had already gone. There wasn't that many there. But I do remember the little hotel there. I also remember that we had movies there every now and then. These traveling shows would come around to see and they'd show us movies. And
where would the movies be shown?
Movie like
where in what building? Would it be open air?
It was their building. They had a tent.
Oh, a tent.
And,
okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they showed these old horror movies, everybody almost got killed at the last second, but then you went back the next night, see, and you got some more of it.
Did pretty much everybody in the whole town go to the movies?
Oh, yeah.
That was a big deal, huh?
And they sang a bunch of songs.
You need some Kleenexes or something?
No, that's fine.
Just holler. I think I got something in there. What about revivals? Did you have any tent revivals that came through?
No, this was not tent revivals there. I don't remember that, but Temple built us a church, what's called non-denominational. Anybody could use it. And so they had a revival there. And their brother Williams out of Rusk came and preached. I guess it must have been all week long. This was in July. Anyhow, there was 19 of us, boys and girls, surrendered to the Lord. And I know I was young, but I was 7 years and 4 months old. I felt the tickling of the Lord. I was on the back row. But I felt the feeling of the Lord that I must make a decision. And so I went down front and I surrendered my life to the Lord. I can't say I lived it like I should have all those times, but I did get away. I'll guarantee you I got away. But there was 19 of us baptized at one day on July the 3rd, 1933. 19, July the 3rd, 1933.
Now, in the river?
In the Neches River. We was at what you call this shallow swimming hole. It was up the river a ways, I don't know, maybe a half a mile or so. And they also carried a bunch of watermelons up there, and they put the watermelons in the river. And so we had a watermelon feast after. And I was a little guy, and I had the rock bottom, and I must have been floating down. Anyhow, Clifford DeVathan, he grabbed my hand. Clifford DeVathan, he worked for Temple and then worked for the Lufkin Energy for a long, long time. He might have been their treasurer, I'm not positive. But Clifford grabbed my hand. And
so you were only like 6 or 7 years old.
Right? I was seven years and 4 months old.
7 years.
So I was young. Very, very young. Lord.
So you remember that, huh? What about school? Do you remember going to school there?
We went to school. Miss Kilgore was my first teacher. We had six grades at Fastra.
Six grades.
One building. And then the seventh grade, we went into Rusk. And they had a junior high and a high school at Rusk. So I was at that age. I went to junior high before we moved from Fastra down to Diboll. I remember really a lot, not a lot, but some, about the school situation. Mr. Thompson, he was our bus driver. Well, Mr. Thompson, we had a
now you're talking about at Rusk now.
At Rusk, okay. No. But he kept the bus out at Fastra. And he had they had a little garage for it or a building for it. But he'd leave the key in that bus.
Gasoline-powered bus?
Gasoline-powered bus. And he'd let us boys go down there and crank that darn automobile. See, we're just youngsters. But we'd go down there and crank that automobile. And some of the Trevathan boys, older ones, see, well, they even got to where they could back it out of there. So that was a big deal for us.
Did y'all go anywhere or just back it up?
Remember the first whooping I ever got. I guess the only whooping I ever got from my daddy. grandmother passed away. Aunt Rose, everybody called Aunt Rose Cox. Ma White, she was an orphan girl. And she was real young when she married Pa White. But anyhow, they had three children. But now, Aunt Alma said she had some children there, you know, that they lost during the ages. But that's the three that I remember. Aunt Alma and Uncle Jimmy White, and then my mother, Johnny Amisa White. And they were a real close family, really. But through the years, well, it just came to that when we first went to dive to Fastra, Jonathan, you would not believe how large those pine trees were. They put just one log on
a logging cart.
Just one log on a logging cart, see? And they had probably six or more mules or something or other. And they were back in the hills area across the river over there, before I remember. And I don't know how they got those logs on and off. But they got those logs there, and then they brought them down to the factory itself. And then they loaded them on the cars and carried them down to Diboll where they processed them. But the first whooping I got, J.D. Birchfield's mother and dad, they were divorced. And she moved to Lufkin. And I'd never been out of Diboll. I mean, out of Fastrow. But anyhow, J.D. wanted me to go with him to
Rusk.
It was a big town of Rusk there. And anyhow, we saw his mother, and his mother had an automobile. And so she brought us back to Fastrow. And I don't know what time, night, but it was at nighttime when we finally got back. And anyhow, my dad there, he had a belt, and he said, "Well, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this for your granddad." Said, "You have had him wear it all afternoon long." See, I didn't tell anybody where it went. Well, didn't think it was necessary. Anyhow, that's the only whooping I ever got in my life. But I should have got it really, because I should have let Paul know where I was gone, because Paul and I was, you know, just like this.
Yeah. Tell me about what you ate. What foods did you eat back then? Today,
mostly,
everybody eats out of packaged
mostly,
stuff.
Mostly, we had a grocery store there, and had a barber shop there. Mr. Kimball was he was our barber. Don't remember the grocery store man, but...
So you ate what you bought at the store? Did anybody grow crops there?
We had crops there, and everybody had a little patch or a garden.
What crops did you grow?
Primarily just vegetables. Now the Mexican boys on the other side of the creek down there, they grew corn and watermelons, and naturally us boys go down there, we'd have to borrow watermelon. They didn't care, but anyhow, we'd go down and eat one of their watermelons and go in swimming into the little creek there.
What about meats?
Meat. We hunted too, but we got our beef from the market there.
Did y'all have wild? Did anybody have wild hogs?
They raised their own hogs. Okay. And I remember that. I remember putting them down in a big old hot barrel, and then they scraped the blooming hogs to skin them. You know, we skin them now, but. They scraped them then, you know, and they saved everything on that hog.
Did you ever get involved in doing that?
I got involved very much, and I did not like it. It stunk, for one thing. But anyhow, you had to scrape and get all the hair off that hog, and then they would cure it, and they had them a little smokehouse, and they'd hang up the hams and whatnot.
Would everybody kind of do it all together
It was kind of individual families that did that, yeah.
Is there a particular time of year that was done?
I'm going to think it was probably in the fall of the year when they started killing the hogs.
And y'all smoke them or salt
smoked
them?
Smoked them. Salted and smoked them.
Okay.
And I know they had some fires out there. I guess they're using hickory logs. But they smoked those hams. Boy, that ham was good to go out there and slice a little piece of that ham off and also use it for catching crawdads. Had to catch crawdads.
Now, the crawdads were used for fishing?
Fishing. And we did do a lot of fishing.
Talk about fishing. How would you fish?
We fished then just poles. Now I was fortunate.
What kind of pole? Cane pole?
Just cane pole.
You just find some cane and.
I was fortunate. We had a peg leg smith there, and he did kind of janitor work, cleaning the toilet, so forth. Out had an old trailer, but he had a boat, and Smith would let me go with him, and I paddled him. And I was young. I'm very young.
Little wooden flat bottom boat.
Flat bottom boat. Yeah, I guess it was Cypress that he made the boat out of.
Mm-hmm. I'd
get in the boat there in the back of it, see, and he got in front, and he had two baits. Let's see, he had a Shannon twin spinner and a spinner bait. What was the name of that? I forget the name of it. He had two baits, though, but he'd catch those trout.
Two artificial baits.
Artificial baits. They said they were trouts, but they was not trouts. All they were just old black bass. But everybody said they were trouts. But he let me paddle him, and so that was good. But Aunt Gertie, she loved to fish.
Did he ever let you use his bait?
Never let me use
it. You were his trolling motor, huh?
all I do, I just paddle him down and up the river.
Did he have a reel, or did he just get on a rod?
No, he had a reel and rod then.
Oh, he had a rod and reel, okay.
Must have been a Shakespeare, I'm going to guess.
Okay.
Because they were, you know, one of the first ones to come up with rods and reels. And I'm guessing now that it was Shakespeare, not Potter.
But he would actually cast out
and
reel it in.
He would actually
cast out and reel it in.
Isn't that something?
Y'all probably thought that was...
I thought, man, I was number one just being able to...
just being able to paddle him around.
Oh,
huh?
Lord, yeah. But we'd go and fish in a river, and we had small hooks. And
what kind of line did he use?
It was a braided line.
Some braided line.
Yeah, they wasn't monofilament, just regular braided line. And Aunt Gertie and I and Ma White, we'd go and we'd catch those, call them crappie or white perch. And I remember what Aunt Gertie used to do so much. If I was fishing over here and I caught a white perch, got it in, you know, we put it on a stringer, and I started putting my bait back there. Well, Aunt Gertie, she had already moved over where I just caught that fish. You know, I just something to do that. I loved it.
Yeah, one fish was there, there might be another fish there.
Ma White passed away, and she woke me up and said, "Son, you need to go get Dr. Evans." And so I went down to woke up Dr. Evans. Wasn't too far down the street. Dr. Evans came up there, and Ma White already passed away while we were gone, and Dr. Evans told me, said, your grandmother's gone, and she died of acute indigestion. Well, we had had a salad that day, a salad made out of vegetable that had been in a garden. But she had made that, and then she had some hot grease, and she put on top of that. Jonathan, for I don't know how many years, but I always thought that salad killed my grandmother. That wasn't no salad. She had a heart attack. But that's cute indigestion. And boy, I would not eat that salad either. No way I was going to eat a salad. Then we come on, and about 1941, Temple decided, well, we had just about done all the logging up there we were going to. And so he moves down Dieball and what's called Red Town, which is kind of east part of town. And, the story goes.
You were about 15 then?
I was 15 then.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what do you mean?
6'11". Yeah, I was 15 then.
In 11th grade? 10th grade?
Yeah. Okay. Moves in nice. I thought it was a nice little house down there. Nothing wrong with them. They're small, but
so the houses were already there. They didn't move the house in Fastrell here. You just moved from Fastrell to here.
And then we lived there for, then I started school, and those girls and boys, they didn't like strangers coming into their school.
The ones who were already here in Dieball.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, they didn't like that coming down there. And so Temple sent part of us to Dieball, part of it to Pineland.
Really?
Yeah.
To Pineland?
Yeah, surely did. Part of Pineland.
Now, did you go to Dieball or Pineland?
I went to Dieball. Went there, I went there in 42 and part of 43. And then 1941, the war broke out. And
Yeah, I wanted to ask you
I was 15 years old then when the war broke out.
Where were you on December 7th, 1941?
I was down at Ryan's Lake hunting, deer hunting, and came back and everybody telling about it. Well, lots of our guys at Dieball, they was upset, and a bunch of them went right on up to Lufkin and volunteered. And some of those boys were... I wish I could remember some of the names. Part of them was the Tavathans, Junior. I forget his name. Anyhow, there's a number of boys went on up from Dieball into Lufkin and volunteered. Well,
y'all had just moved here.
Just moved there, right, see.
Because December 7th of 41, December is when they shut down Fastrell.
Yeah, I mean.
So, I mean, y'all weren't here long at all.
No, I guess we shut down Fastrell. Must have been about September or somewhere in that neighborhood.
September, okay. They probably started phase. Yeah. December must have been the final date or something.
It was,
So you had already enrolled in school that
school
fall.
School and gone that fall, and then I went to next year in 42, and 43 rolled around.
So the Trevathans, they were already, you knew them from when you were at Fashtville, right?
Okay. Yeah, some of those boys went on into service, and some more of them that die ball, if I can remember the name, but they went in also.
Were you ever able to make friends with the ones who were already here in die ball?
Yes.
Or did y'all?
I made friends with every one of them. Harold Turner was the guy that took care of the ice situation there in die ball. And so his wife wanted me to continue his ice business. So she hired me, and I got a couple of boys that I knew. And then we had two ice trucks. And they'd get ice from Lufkin and bring it down to die ball and put an ice house. And then 300-pound blocks. And I'd always brag I could pick up 300 pounds. Really, I wasn't 300 pounds. I picked up the end of 300 pounds.
And
I told people, I could pick up 300 pounds. And I tell them the story. I was just bragging, I guess, wasn't it?
And big ice tongs?
Yeah, big old ice tongs. Pick up that. But then we chipped it up 25 or 50 pound blocks.
How would you chip it?
We had a little ice chipper.
Okay.
And ice was already scored.
Okay.
When we got it.
It was scored in Lufkin.
Uh-huh.
Lufkin scored. Okay.
And Temple, he had us bring ice over there in his mill, see, in a sawmill, so forth. So we made that round real, real early and filled up his ice cans or his water cans with ice.
How was the ice house insulated?
It was just real thick wood.
Sawdust?
Yeah, it was. Just thick wood. And I think that's what it was. It was primarily just thick wood, insulation. And I remember they had a little canvas on the side of it, too. That might have been some preservation. But I was going with Mabel at that particular time. And anyhow, Mr. Richardson, he was Harold's son.
I'm sorry, Mr.
Richardson.
Richardson, okay.
Yeah, he was Harold's son-in-law. Oh, I remember her name. Her name was Hazel. She's the one that hired us.
For the ice business?
For the ice business. Well, we lived at that particular time, we were right close to Mr. White's office, close to the sawmill. We had moved from Red Town over to that real nice, big old building.
Mr. White of the Handle Factory?
Yeah, right next to his office. And my bed was right there by our porch. And so Mr. Richardson, he'd come by early, early, early and wake me up, see. And and then I'd go down and get on the ice truck. But
This is when you were like 15, 16?
Yeah, okay. 15, 16.
And y'all would just go, would you go through the mill? Did you go to people's houses as
we,
well?
We went to the mills first, and then went to all the houses.
All the houses.
That way I got to know all the people. And
How would you do it? Just deliver? Did they put a card out or
they
something?
They had a little card that said, I think, maybe 25, 50, 100, or 12 and a half, see, and that's what we put in our ice box.
You just go and read the card.
Went to the colored group, Mexican group, and everybody. And everybody was the same, really. And I know we called them a different word, but listen, we had respect for those colored people. We love those colored people. And I don't care what the other guy said. When I say a nigger, that doesn't mean that I hate that person. That's just a name that we grew up with. That's all it was. And it was not disrespectful at all. In fact, I still know one right down there now that he and I was raised together. Can't think of his name right now either. He's still living, and he and I were buddies when he was kids. And Marcellus Jones, that's his name. And Marcella's aunt and uncle raised him, and her name was Lily Mae, and we called her Aunt Lily Mae, and his name was Mac, and I called him Uncle Mac. and we ate together and everything else. It just wasn't no big deal, really. But they lived on one side of the track, and we lived on one side of the track, and that's the way it was. But anyhow, let me get back to that deal that he woke me up one morning. Boy, I must have been sleepy.
Mrs. Richardson?
Mr. Richardson. Yeah. And so they had a little old a bridge there going across something or other in the mill area.
A little bridge?
Bridge.
Walkway?
And I must have went to sleep going over that bridge. I run off the side.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So I didn't know at that particular time, but Mabel's daddy and his brother-in-law, Cecil Hogue, they came and got the truck out somewhere or another. But, oh, it was so nice. It was so nice. Then we had some nice teachers at Diabol, too, just as sweet as they could be. And I can't remember, but one of them was Dixie Hunt.
Hunt.
Dixie
okay.
Hunt, yeah. She wasn't much older than we were. And, she was my sweetheart. Well, she wasn't really, but she was just nice to us. And so in about November, I just could not stand it any longer that I would in the service. Because
now, this would be November after the, this would be November of 42?
November of 43.
Oh, 43, okay.
Yeah, 43. Year had already gone by.
Were you still in school?
I was still in school.
Still in school, okay, November 43.
And one of my buddies, Dick Birchfield, and other Birchfield boys, Dick went in the Marines, and he is a year older than I was, about a year and a half. But I just couldn't stand in Dick, because he and I were hunting buddies, and him going ahead and getting in the Marines, and here I was just hunting and fishing all I was doing. So I decided that I'm going to get in the Marines. And so I went up there, and we had a...
In Lufkin?
At Lufkin.
Went to a recruiter?
Yeah,
okay.
Recruiter. Her name is Miss Anderson. And I didn't know this, but Miss Anderson knew my grandmother. And they had a horrible incident, one at Towns. And I don't remember which one of the areas it was, Bluff City or someplace or another. A lady was washing clothes, and she got her gown or got her dress fire, and it killed her.
Mm.
Well, Miss Anderson and my grandmother both knew about that, and I didn't know Miss Anderson even knew who I was, but anyhow, I told her who it was. And
now, this is at the Marines?
At the Marine, at the place where you register.
Okay,
register.
So it's not any particular branch.
Because
I was going to ask you, why the Marines?
Well,
I don't want to interrupt your story, yeah. but I want to get to that part,
okay.
too.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I went in there and told her I wanted to get into the Marines, and she said, well, you have to be 18. And I said, she asked me first how old I was, see, and I told her, 17. You have to be 18. And I said, well. And so I went back
home. And
this
was December 2nd?
December the 2nd. So I went back home. I didn't talk to no one about this. But December the 3rd at 8 o'clock or before, I was up on her doorsteps. And when she come by there and she said, what are you doing here? I said, today's my birthday. Good Lord. It didn't bother me at all. It really did not bother me lying. Anyhow, she signed
me. And you said it with a straight face? You didn't laugh or smile?
I said it with a straight face. And I smiled then. I still try to smile. But she took me in and made all the registration papers out. And then Red Rector and I, we went up to Dallas, was inducted. And then in January, the 2nd or 3rd, somewhere along in there, it wasn't too far after December the 3rd, we went in and went into San Diego.
Why the Marines? Why not the Army or the Navy?
I had always heard about the Marines, and I just loved what they did, and I knew they was all in the Pacific, and I didn't want to go to the European area. I didn't want to be in the Army. I didn't want to be in the Navy, nothing like that.
Well, why not Europe? I'm just curious.
I want to get in the Pacific, see. That's where he had all those islands and all those jungles and stuff. in Europe, you know, they're just like the United States over there. It wasn't like in the jungle.
So you wanted adventure?
I wanted to be there. So I did hit San Diego, and my Cecil Hogue, he was in the National Guard, and another real good friend, I forget his name too, he was in the National Guard, or Texas Guard. They let me go with them. See, so I had a little experience, military experience, because they let me shoot, and I helped them cook.
Now, where would y'all do this?
We'd go out Polk County someplace or another on kind of a little bivouac area and, you know, go through your procedures and march and get the commands, you know, and setting up some obstacles.
So you had already been doing that?
I had already been doing that. But when I got to Dago, I just knew, boy, I had it made. And so our drill instructor, he was over there, and, boy, I went up drill instructor and started talking to him and said something or other, and I said the wrong thing. That guy, he started letting me have it with both feet, and I never had heard some of those curse words he was using, but he let me know that he was a sir, and any time I said something to him, it was sir, yes sir, and that's it, nothing else. Anyhow, well, that went along good.
Let me just ask you this before we get into that. Were there any particular, this is 43 now, were there any particular movies or like newsreels, like the Bataan Death March and stuff? How much of the news that you got or movies influenced you in joining, or was there any of that?
I don't remember a movie then.
Okay.
That.
But did you go to movies where they would have carried
some of the movie tone news reels
and things?
They had the movie house down Dieball there in Antlers Hotel. And
did some of that influence you?
It might have had. It could have had. Who knows?
Okay.
It could have had. I forget the guy's name that run the honky-tonk there.
Shirley Daniels,
yeah. Shirley Daniels ran a hand at honky-tonk. And we played some of them old-timey dancing songs, and we bounced the floor there and honky-tonk quite a bit.
How would you have gotten your news? You know, you mentioned you wanted to go not to Europe but to the islands. How would you have gotten the news of what was going on about the war?
We got very little news. Our newspaper editor of here at Lufkin, Mr. Bowmere, yeah, he wrote some articles, see.
So y'all kept in touch through the newspaper.
So we got through a little news through the newspaper, and we knew that, you know, it wasn't going good for us. And
radio?
Didn't say a lot, either.
Okay.
And I don't think they wanted to get rid of too many bad stories out, actual stories, because we was in bad shape. I had a brother-in-law that was Pearl Harbor. His ship had just moved out of Pearl Harbor when they bombed. Another brother-in-law was in Corregidor. He was on the they have a name for it. He was on a death march.
The Bataan
Death March? He was on the Bataan Death March, right, see. You know, that boy never told me a thing about that.
Really?
And he was in a prison all that time. And I don't know how those darn Japanese treated those prisoners. It wasn't good like you and I treat them. They treated them bad, bad, bad. But he would never mention a word about that to me. But that's after the war, see.
After, you're right, right. Yeah.
But we got there at Dago, and everything was...
So you're learning, you're adapting to military life.
I was adapted to it and just went in real, real good, because I could march good, and I knew what that M1 was. And poor little Yankee boys, they never had a gun on their shoulder.
Hmm.
And if they got out of step, well, the drill instructor, he told us to kick them in the butt. See, it's kind of hard to kick your buddy in the butt, but anyhow, that was part of the procedure. Got over that, and they're going to assign us where we're going to go to. Well, I went down and told a guy, I want to be a scout sniper. I said, no, you can't be a scout sniper. You're too small.
So this is in early 44 now, right?
Yeah. And 40. Yeah, 40. Yeah, early 44. Yeah, early 44.
And meanwhile,
I was 150, about 150 pounds, but like I told him, I could pick up that 300 pounds, but it wasn't 300 pounds.
And all the while you're here in San Diego, they were starting to bomb Iwo Jima, aren't they?
Everything. They was bombing everything, fella. They was bombing everything. But we had a good Navy. We had some good admirals in the Navy. Anyhow, that old boy let me get in the scout sniper, so I went to scout sniper school over at Green's Farm, stayed there about 3 weeks. Also, that was OCS school.
What did you train with? What weapon?
Well, see, we could have any kind of weapon we wanted in scout sniper school.
For sniper?
Oh, man. They had some of the prettiest scopes. I had never seen a scope like that. I bet you that scope was a foot long.
What distance
I'm not sure of what kind of scope it was. It wasn't a Redfield or Leopold, something like that. But it was a real good scope. And use that 03 bolt action, see, the Springfield.
Uh-huh. Was it 308 or 333 caliber?
30-06.
30-06, yeah. Okay.
Had a spotter behind me. We shot a 1,000 yards a bunch of times. And at 500 yards, I do not believe I could miss at 500 yards.
Is that from lying position or
lying
squatting position, lying down?
Lying position or squatting position.
500
yards. I just don't believe I could ever miss at 500 yards. But we had Thompson machine gun, used those. What else did we have? Had pistols.
These the 45, the
45, those 45, big old six shooters, what they were.
Oh, six revolvers,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, revolvers. But we could shoot any time we wanted to, and I was a little old hunter, see. So every chance that I got out, we wasn't in school, well, I'd run down the rifle range, see, and grab up one of those weapons and bang, bang, bang away. See, I just loved it. Just loved it. And then we hit, left, Green's Farm and took out and went over to Hawaii on Azalea City. We stayed at Hawaii for a replacement. I get the replacement number just for a short time. And the 3rd Marine Division was formed in Camp Lejeune. And then from Camp Lejeune went to San Diego on September the 22nd, 1942. They was formed. And then that was eventually my group, 3rd Marine Division. They went to New Zealand. And I thought New Zealand, you know, is way above. Listen, New Zealand is below Australia. It's way, way down there. And that's what they were down there for, is to protect some of those Australian people. But my Danny Marshall, Captain Danny Marshall, later on my captain, he was a farmer from New Jersey, Vermont. I mean, a farmer. And so he helped those people down there in New Zealand farm. So they just loved him. And they had, you know, lots of those darn old sheep running around. So, but he helped them a great deal. And then our group then left from New Zealand.
So you went to New Zealand?
No, I did not.
Oh, you're talking about your group. Okay.
Yeah, my group. And then they went to, from New Zealand up to Guadalcanal, to Bougainville, and they took Bougainville, and then they went from Bougainville over Guadalcanal for more training. Well, the Army kind of found, and I hate to say this, but anyhow, the Army didn't do what they were supposed to, so they brought our group back from Bougainville over to Guadalcanal, and vice versa, and got rid of the Japs then too. And then it took off from there and went to Guam. And that's when I joined them in Guam. They declared...
After the battle or before the battle?
I went there during the battle.
During the battle, okay.
Battle of Guam.
Okay, and you joined up with them then.
Yeah, and...
How many approximately were... with you coming in, I mean, y'all haven't seen combat yet, right?
No. Okay. No. We as a replacement group.
Okay.
And they from Hawaii then sent us to Guam, and I joined 21st Regiment on Guam.
Did you see combat in
Yes.
Guam? Okay.
They secured the island on August the 15th. I must have got there about August 16th, 17th, or 18th. But they were still a bunch of Japs on Guam. And so since I had a scout, well, then, you know, they did put me up in front of our patrol, had lots of patrols. And that right down my, man, you talk about jungles. It was jungle. In fact, they were so thick there sometimes you had to take your machete and cut you a hole so you could crawl through the darn jungle. But anyhow, let me tell you about my first shot. I scout, and there's Jap come up out there in front of me, probably not over 100 yards. And he probably saw me about the same time I saw him. So I just raised... I didn't have a scope then, just an
M1. 30 caliber.
Yeah. And so I raised up that M1 and cracked down on him, and he just dropped. Well, I always thought, I said, I don't know whether I hit him. I don't know whether I hit him or not. But I wasn't that gung-ho to go through that jungle over there where he fell and find out. So as far as I know, the first Jap I shot at, I missed. I don't know if it's true or not. But anyhow, we went on lots of patrols. Oh, and I got one just so cute. We had a second lieutenant came in as a replacement. I don't know who he was. Anyhow, well, he was kind of halfway assigned to me. So we took the rear echelon to the front. And we had a huge... there was a huge radio station on Guam, way back up in the jungle that the Japs had built. Well, they were still communicating with Tokyo, and they wanted us to take that radio out. So they told us where it was, so we went in a truck as far as we could, then went through the jungle. Well,
How many are in your group?
They must have been 20 at least.
Okay.
And... we didn't know this, but they also had given another group the same objective. It hit it, see. And we was going to run parallel with each other, and I didn't know it. And I'm sure that officers knew that there had another patrol over there. Anyhow, it was second lieutenant. He was me, babe. We was back to back there, and he looked over and he saw him. And so he,
oh, I got him.
Guess what it was? It was a Marine on that other patrol. He hit in the leg. I got him. Oh, he was proud. Anyhow, we cut a couple of bamboo, big old bamboo cane, or what you want to call it, and took our shirts off and buttoned up the shirts in. We made a little just a litter for him. And we loaded this boy that he hit in the leg on that litter. And so we had to go back then instead of going on. But we went back and dumped him off down there to truck, and they carried him to it. So, but then we went on up there then, and we did go to the radio station. And they had just a few Japs there, and that other patrol, I guess, because I didn't see any live Japs at that radio station. Came back. But that's a... one of the funny things happened. But we did make a complete sweep of that island.
Guam. Yeah.
Complete sweep. And, I mean, we just pooped out the whole group. And we just started just making an advance. And we'd go so far every day. And then at nighttime, well, you know, we'd dig a hole. And just like we had regular combat, get in that hole and see what happened. And we also put out, this is another key thing, we put out some alarm systems. We had wire, and we would put tin cans. It was empty tin cans on that wire. Okay, if a Jap hit that wire, well, then the tin can, you'll make a noise. So you know something, the enemy there, so you shoot. Well, sure enough, tin can started going off, and everybody started shooting. Turned out a little old deer. Oh, good Lord, mercy. We made a deal, though, and Captain Danny Marshall, like I said, he was my captain. We got to the end of the island, had to go down a cliff, and I think there was 13 of them down there. And they killed most of them, but there's a couple of geisha girls, and then one boy just dehydrated so bad, just terrible. I bet he didn't weigh 80-some-odd pounds. Well, Captain Danny Marshall wanted Sergeant Blackmore. Yes, I forget the sergeant's name now. It'll come to us. But anyhow, he wanted the sergeant to strap that Japanese on his back and take him up that cliff and come down. That little sergeant, he cursed. He wasn't about to take that Jap. So Danny Marshall, just see what kind of person he was, he strapped that Jap on his back, and he carried him up that thing. Danny was one more super. In fact, after the war, he went to Japan and taught English. He was a professor, and he ended up retiring from Tufts University, and he must have been a super, super guy. But anyhow, he took him over back, and we left there and stayed there a long time, and we captured a little Korean boy, and I don't know what his name was. He gave me a book, but I put the book in one of my sea bags coming back from Guam to the States. Somebody swiped, I say an army boy swiped it, but I don't know whether it's true or not. But anyhow, they swiped that sea bag, and I didn't get the book. But they assigned this little Korean to me, and I nicknamed him Butch Roosevelt. And everybody knew who Butch Roosevelt was. And I'd take him out on patrol with him.
Now, how old was he?
Butch was older than I was. Oh, okay. He was probably 25. He was one of their construction engineers, Japanese constructor. He was their laborer, all he was. But he didn't like the Japanese at all, man. He didn't like them at all. But he'd go with me on patrol.
Could he speak English?
No. A little bit. Very little bit. But we communicated enough. But we'd go to these caves there on Guam, and he'd speak the Japanese language, see, and trying to... he got some of them to come out and surrender.
Hmm.
And I thought that was nice. And some of them that he didn't. And so then our demolition boys or either flamethrowers, then, you know, they killed people in there. But I never did trust Butch enough to give him a rifle. But I did give him a machete. And, you know, you can do lots of damage with a machete. But I did give him a machete for protection there. But we left Guam, heading out to Iwo, and
What were you told when y'all were left? Did you know you were going to Iwo? What did they tell you?
Yes. See, I was in the intelligence section, okay. G2. Captain Dan Marshall was an intelligence officer. We knew where we were going. We had big old maps. We also had what would you call it? Had altitude of the
a relief model.
Yeah, it was a model of the land sea. Okay, and the Air Force would go take shots, bring it back, and they'd bring it to
us. Okay, so you'd been studying photographs and everything
for
a while.
Yeah, and we'll go back. And Danny Marshall, he'd look at those, and he said, "I don't know what's the problem, but something is wrong here. Something is wrong." And every time you'd get them, see, well, the scenery would be a little bit different. And what those Japanese people were doing, see, they're making those caves, and they're getting that dirt out of that cave and throwing it out, see. Well, you're getting a different picture looking down at it. But Danny said something is wrong. We took off USS Bolivar, one I was on.
Say that name again.
USS Bolivar, B-O-L-I-V-E-R.
Oh, Bolivar, okay, Bolivar, yeah.
And then later on, I did meet two of the boys. They were Higgins boat operators on the Bolivar. I met them in New Orleans. And I was really glad to see him. I still had a little chip of eating chip from USS Bolivar, see, and so I gave it to one of them.
A what chip?
Eating chip. You know, it gave you a little chip, and I guess you use that to eat with. Or
chip. Okay, yeah. I see what you're saying, yeah.
But Cummins was his name, and I always kidded him. Every time I got a group, I'd always kid him. I said, yeah, they did good. He was on that darn Higgins boat, and as soon as it hit the beach, he had that thing in full reverse. And he might have had, because they didn't want to stay there. But anyhow, we had lots of fun, and I still communicate with his wife. Well, in fact, both of the guys' wife. Both guys are already dead now. But we hit that beach, and Jonathan, you cannot just visualize or trying to pantomime. Just we hit it the second day.
So February 19th was when
February the 19th when our group hit. The 4th and the 5th Division hit. We were supposed to have come in the middle, okay, but we didn't because they didn't think they'd need us. Tell you what, there were so many ships and bombing and airplane stuff hitting that island that if somebody would have told me, said, well, Johnny, going to take y'all a long time? No. It's probably not going to take over 2 or 3 days to take that island.
Well, they had flown, I think, 27,000 sorties for 70 days.
How could anybody survive? No way. But anyhow, we found out different.
So you yourself went in on the 20th. Is that what you're saying?
I came in one day. We went in the second day afterwards.
Okay. In the daylight or at night?
In the daylight. We went in the morning there. But there were so many casualties on the beach
by that time,
from the day before that the beachmaster, he waved our 21st Regiment off. Danny Marshall's ship, because I know who he was, they let us come in on the Higgins boat. And me and him and the other guy that I remember, well, it's three or four, but only Stanfield was my scout buddy. But we went in on the 20th, and I know I was silly, but...
And you were showing me one time, you came in right here near Suribachi, right?
I came in somewhere right along in here, yeah, okay. Close to Suribachi, because I could see it real, real good. There were so many dead people on my right and my left. I just couldn't believe there's so many dead people there. But it was. And I was as gung-ho, I guess. Anyhow, they had that little beach area. Had that volcanic ash, sand, and you take one step and go back, too. But anyhow, I got up to the top of it because I wanted to see over, see what was up in front of me. There's one boy from the artillery group. He cursed me out good and proper. He said, get your so-and-so head back down. So I got my head back down from the horizon there. So I didn't see what was ahead of me. And
But you're not able to see to even shoot at anything, are you?
No, nothing shoot at.
So you're just trying to...
Just survive. Just
find a spot of ground and...
Trying to dig a little bit and get on it and just stay there and...
Total chaos, huh?
Yeah, total chaos, exactly what it was.
And shells going off all around, being shot
all
at.
All night long, and there's a number of boys got killed real close to me, but none ever hit me, so I guess I was lucky. But the third day, that would be the 21st, okay? Well, since Danny was G2 officer, intelligence officer, okay, so he knew the whole island deal. So they ordered him out to go to each one of the regiments, go to command post of each regiment and get their exact location. Now this is for security reasons or friendly fire reasons, see, so that they wouldn't get shot at. So we did that, went up and all up through there.
And meanwhile, you're just in the open.
We was in the open. We're in the open then.
Just crawling around in sand, huh?
That's it. We was already in the open. We was already on the airfield. And and sell.
And they'd already dropped gasoline and everything, so there was no vegetation.
Nothing left.
Nothing.
Let me tell you something other. Danny and I and Oney Stanfield, we went on up, got all of the information that Danny needed, and then we came back and Danny reported all the location, everybody's location. But we run across just a hole in the ground, and there was a Japanese soldier laying on that ground. He had on a silk uniform. He had on riding boots.
What color was the silk?
It was bluish color.
Blue silk.
Blue kind of silk. And his boots were just beautiful. He had on silver spurs. Well, Danny, he started going over, and I got his name here.
He was dead or alive?
No, he was dead. And see, I don't know how he got killed. He was just laying in the hole. But how you spell his name is T-A-K-E-I-C-H-I, Takeshi, N-I-S-H-I, Nishi. But he was the one that won the Golden Olympics in 1932, had in California, and he was one of those riders.
Hmm.
In fact, I understand.
An equestrian rider?
The horse rider deal. I understand that they put a horse on Iwo for him, and he rode it. But he was a captain of the artillery group, I think who he was. But anyhow, Danny, he was going over the body, trying to get some, you know, intelligent information from him. And Oney and I, this guy had a beautiful saber. So we took the saber off of him, and Oney got his spurs. And anyhow, we went on back and gave the report. We kept those spurs and that saber. And later on, it was Sergeant Bill. I don't know where he got the watermelon, but he brought a watermelon to us. And we had this saber. So we had a big picture. Bill, he was a photographer too, and a Marine, Sergeant Marine. He wrote a book, and I fish remember the name of it. But we cut the watermelon, and they got a picture of it, and we got, you know, I can tell Owen and John Rakowski and a few more of my scout buddies, and cut that watermelon. And then we took that saber. I know we're kind of getting a little bit ahead, but we took the saber back to Guam and carried it down to the Air Force unit, and we got 8 fills of liquor for that saber. I just wonder how much that saber would really be worth now.
Do you know where it is by any chance?
No way, no way. Anyhow, well, we came back and we sold 7 of those 8 fills to the boys, Marines, for $50 a filth. So we kept one of those for municipal purposes, you know, in case we got snake bit over there. You understand that?
At Guam?
Yeah, yeah. No. Still on Iwo.
Oh, still on Iwo, okay.
Yeah. No. No, you're right. Yeah, we was at Guam when when we sold it.
When you did your bargaining.
But only he kept the spurs.
Okay.
Mother and I, Mabel and I, have hunted for Oney for years and years and years, and I just knew the policemen and lots of towns, and they'd look, and I couldn't find what it was. We were spelling Stanfield wrong. It was S-T-A-N-F-I-E-L-D. His name was Oney E. Stanfield. Well, I found out about 2 years ago, son-in-law was down here. He's a captain and police chief there at Garland. They got some sort of an instrument, man. They can tell. They know all about you, Jonathan. I guarantee you they know all about you. He looked Oney Stanfield and said, yeah, Oney E, and he told me that what the E stood for, but it's S-T-A-N-D-F-I-E-L-D. If Oney passed away in 1970, I got a copy of his obituary. He had 5 sons, and I've contacted all the 5 sons, and it just gone. Anyhow, we went on, and after that, well, we got here at Airfield Number 1 area.
How long did it take you to get from the beach to Airfield Number 1?
It didn't take very long, but you didn't go very far.
Yeah.
Boy, I mean, they had you fired down. See, they
talk about that sand. What was the sand like?
That sand was kind of. I've got some of it at the house. People brought it back to me.
Did it have that salty
kind of
smell?
It's a kind of a black sand. All it was, just pulled right. I guess volcano.
Real fine or thick?
Real fine.
Real fine.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, it wasn't too fine. No, it was. It was kind of coarse, but you just could not walk in it.
Yeah, it was all stirred up.
It sure was.
What about the smells? Do you remember any smells?
Well, the dead people, yeah. Remember that. Remember that? Well, very well, Jonathan. You never forget it. We was laying down here on Airfield Number 1, and they're shooting above us. And this was 19th, 21st, 5 days. After the campaign gone on, we should have already been on the other end of the island. We were still there on our ship. And the boats started to, there must have been 1,000 more boats there. But everybody started blowing their darn horns, see. And you think the war is over or something. But anyhow, I looked back and they was raising the flag. And so can say I was one of the persons that saw the flag go up.
On Mount Suribachi.
Okay. Isn't that something? But we went on from there, and it just got worse and worse and worse.
Now, did you ever, I know I'm getting ahead, but when things had settled down, were y'all ever able to go up?
No. We went, object was going to the other end of the island.
The other end of the island,
right.
Okay.
Keto Point, that was about our object.
How do you say that? Catano? Catino?
Yeah.
Catano Point.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So y'all came in down here. I guess this would be
We came in right here, I guess, in this area.
Okay.
And went right up this way. The fifth on this side and the fourth on this side.
Do these names mean anything to you? this yellow one, does that mean anything?
I think this is about yellow one is where about we went into. I'm on guess.
But y'all didn't call it that. I mean,
no,
not that you remember. Okay.
I don't remember that. And I should, because I kept a little diary myself and where we were and all.
So y'all came in here, hit the airfield, and then kind of went down the middle.
Right on up.
The middle of the island.
And,
back
we got Airfield Number 2, Modiyama Village. Oh, good Lordy. We lost about 600 men on Airfield Number 2. 600 men. Colonel Duplantis was my colonel. Colonel Withers was our regimental colonel, and Graysby Erskine was our general. Anyhow, we got finally see the your tanks and stuff. They couldn't even come up that sand. So they used bulldozers or something or other and brought them up. I think we got 12 tanks up here, and they knocked out 6 of them.
Mm.
So Colonel Duplantis told Oney and I and gave us explicit instructions, go find that gun knocking those tanks out. And sure enough, Oney and I, we took off, and I don't remember where it was, but in some of these cliff areas right in here, we found the gun that was shooting and knocking those tanks out, okay? We found them. We called back in to Colonel Erskine, and he notified the Air Force, and then they bombed it, but they didn't do any good. But anyhow, they saw Oney and I at the same time, so they started mortaring us, shooting mortars at us, and this is unusual. But there's a big old hole there where one of those seashells had just knocked a big hole in the ground. So we jumped in that hole, and they started lobbing those mortars at us. And one of those mortars went between my legs and didn't go off.
Mm.
You don't think the Lord would with me?
Mm.
Well, there was a blacksmith down at Diabol. Oh, Lord, I forget his name now. But anyhow, the blacksmith had taken a World War I bayonet about that long, and he had cut it down. And he had sharpened both sides of that bayonet, and made me a knife out of it and sent it to me. Why can't I remember that guy's name? Anyhow, well, I had that bayonet with me at that particular time, and I'm at that knife, and it dropped out of my little old scabbard he gave me, and that knife is still in that hole. I didn't go back and get it. But anyhow, we went on up here, and just I'm going to tell you something other now that's kind of, it's questionable, but I think it's the truth. The day before, we was up someplace in here, and I still had my knife at that particular time. I had made a long, long shot, and on the M1, has a rear sight, so you just raise up that rear sight just as high as it goes, see, and I had a pair of binoculars, and so I just used Kentucky windage, and I shot from here over here on this side. They said I made the longest shot on the island, but that's not so. That's just somebody talking. But anyhow, I left my sight up. Why, I don't know. I shouldn't have, but I left the sight up. Maybe I forgot it. But just at dusk and dark, well, there was a big old mound of dirt. And Oni and I went up on this mound of dirt, and not knowing what it was, I just thought it was just a mound of dirt. We stayed there, and next morning my group, the 21st Regiment, they moved out. We was moving forward. And they was probably 15 or 20 Japanese came out of that. What it was, we was on top of a cave. And we couldn't see the mouth of it, you know, unless you look right over. There's probably 15 or 20 Japanese came out of that cave and just went up there and started shooting at our boys. Well, Owen and I, we didn't even have to aim. We just, you know, just started pulling the trigger fast as could. But we killed them pretty fast. Well, and this is the bad part of it, Jonathan, and I hope I don't break down. Just from nowhere right to my left, there was a green uniform over there and a helmet come up right over, it was a log. And so I just aimed it, the Jap, I thought.
Yeah, this is kind of dusk.
No, it was daylight.
Daylight. Okay, I'm sorry.
It was early in the morning after we'd shot that bunch of them.
Okay.
Anyhow, I knocked his helmet off. And then I could see, or I thought he was a Marine. This has always been on my heart. Everybody tells me, John, that was not a Marine. Why would a Marine be there? That bunch of Japs, see? But he had a green uniform on and a hat. And I didn't look at his face, and I wished I looked at his face to see whether he was a Marine or a Jap. But all the psychiatrists and people I talk to me tells me, tried to make me feel better, said John, that had to be a Jap. That was not a Marine. But that's been on my heart. I've prayed about this, Jonathan, I have. But, you know, I wouldn't want to kill a Marine for the last thing in the world. But anyhow, I had to go get him. And I had to go in front of this cave, and I looked in down the cave, and there were two Japs. One sat on the ground with, he had his finger on a darn Nambu machine gun, and the other was standing up by him. Well, they didn't pull the trigger, and that was their mistake. And I just ducked down as fast as I could and pulled a grenade pin, and I think I either held it. Four and a half or five, I don't remember, but they told us we had a period there of time, you know, that was safe period before the grenade would go off. Anyhow, I held it about a half a second too long, because when I dropped it in the cave, well, the thing went off, and that's why I can't hear in my left ear right now. But anyhow, I went on and got the boy over there, grabbed a hold of his leg and pulled him back behind that big old mound of dirt. Somebody hit me. I don't know who he was, but somebody had a pistol in their hand. Anyhow, he grabbed hold of the other leg, see, and put it around there. And then they got a cord and they put him on a litter and carried him on, I guess, on down the beach. But
that was somewhere in this ridge over here.
It was somewhere in this ridge right in here.
Between Airfield 2 and Nishi or whatever.
Airfield and Motoyama.
And again, you're still carrying the M1. I mean, that's your main weapon,
that
right?
That's what I used there, yeah. Now, I saw after I shot this boy, and I don't know why I get where we're going to go forward, and I don't know why I looked down at my rifle, but I saw that my sight was way up, and I forgot what I had done, but there was an M1 laying on the ground. And so I just threw my M1 away and grabbed that one up because that was okay and went on. But I'm going to throw something out to you right now. Why were we on that mound of dirt? Why was Owen and I on that mound of dirt? We didn't have no business being up there. Why was my sight way up like it was? I just wonder how many lives that we saved by shooting that many Japanese people. Because, see, they're shooting at us, our group, a bunch of them. Anyhow, that night or the night after that, Owen and I was up front, and it was late at night, and I heard this Marine, I thought, hollering, "Corman," and it's very, very disturbing noise that somebody that's hurt, you know, hollering out a Corman. Yeah, he did. And so at that particular time, I still had my knife with me. And so I grabbed that knife out, and I know this is not kind of, but anyhow, I grabbed my knife out, and I jumped out of that hole, and I only grabbed my foot. And John said, "That's a Jap." I said, "No, that's a Marine." "No, that's a Jap." "No, it's a Marine. You can hear him." And he sounded just like an American way of saying Corman. Anyhow, only convinced me that it was a Jap, and I didn't go after him. But I thought I could take care of him. But next morning, sure enough, it was old darn Japs over there, not a Marine. So I say that Oney saved my life right there.
Yeah.
I do believe it.
Y'all were all looking out for each other.
And then let me tell you another story. I know this is one of those stories, but we was pinned down someplace in here, and the Nambu machine gun was shooting right across us. Well, one of the boys got hit. It wasn't Westmoreland, boy. It was, because that's a different time. Westmoreland, he was one of the big football players here. Here's my outfit. Got killed. And I'll tell you about it in a minute. But, where was I?
You were ran somewhere up in here. Yeah. After.
And this guy, he was hollering over there. He'd been wounded. And there's a big old Marine just came up from our group, stood up, big one, went out there and grabbed that boy up and brought him right back through that and laid him down over in our area and left. Nobody had never seen that guy before. Nobody knew he was. Now, who was that fella? I'm going to let you think. Tell you what, it makes you wonder. It makes you wonder. It makes you wonder why there's Oney and I up there saving all those lives. Well, there's lots of stories there. We lost 6,900 and some odd men on that. And we lost, like I said, we lost 600 there going up an airfield. But it was bloody, bloody, bloody. And another good time, the Lord with me, must not have been. We got some water. And so we pulled our shoes off and we was washing our feet. And we had a hole here and they had a little ridge to it. Instead of me getting down in the hole, I got up on that ridge and sat down and was washing my feet during a sniper shot. I was bent over like this. That bullet went under both arms through my jacket and hit Dave Winfrey right in the back of his head. That darn it.
This is how many days after?
I don't remember. I don't remember. Kind of days went into, I couldn't tell you what it was, but anyhow, killed Dave, and I never did go, I didn't ever try to get a hold, because I knew where he lived. Why didn't I go tell his parents or say something to him? But I didn't. Anyhow, Dave, he was barefooted, and they got a stretcher up there and carried him back down to the beach area. But Nick White, he was a guy that took care of our count of how many had got killed and their name and so forth. Well, Nick was there, and Nick, I didn't know Nick at that time. But he said he'd always remember that that boy barefooted and him going down to the beach. And later years, I got a hold of a boy here in Austin that I knew, Pat Luckett. And Pat was very good friends, Nick. And Nick had seen Pat and had thought Pat had got killed because he was real wounded bad and carried him down to the beach. And so I got the two names together, and so we met then in California, one of our reunions, those two boys got together, and I was so glad, and because they was glad to see each other. And Nick, he retired. He's a professor of university there of Tennessee, Alabama, and he's a super, super guy. But went on through there, and got to the end of the island, and one of our captains of K Company, I Company, was killed, Sullivan. And so Colonel Plantis, he put Danny Marshall in charge of that rifle company. And Danny had never been in a rifle company before, but anyhow, he did a good job. I know he did a good job. Got up there, and so they went down and got some water in a canteen and sent it back to her down here. And they put a little note on it that not for human consumption. And that was the first seawater that they had got from the island. It's brought back here to our general, Graves B. Erskine. It was, you know, something to deal.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, where would you have gotten your fresh water? Just all the water that was brought ashore, right?
All ashore.
There was no fresh water on the island.
See, that was so bad on these Japanese people there. They didn't have anything to drink. That's why they had one banzai right at the last there, and that General Kuribachi, I think he must have led that banzai attack right on the beach area. The Air Force is down, and the Air Force didn't have any weapons. And I've got pictures of them, and lots of them was killed. And they think Kuribachi was killed there. They don't know for sure.
Were there any Japanese planes on the island when y'all were there, or they
no,
all got rid of them?
All gone.
They're all gone.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they were still some there.
And but they were disabled,
yeah,
I'm sure, yeah.
I got a little piece of their plane, and I brought it back with me.
Zero, I guess?
Zero.
Zeros,
yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking at an aerial photograph here. So y'all came ashore here and went to Airfield 1 and then 2. And then y'all kind of worked your way back.
Yeah.
I see it dark here. Is that from a cloud or
no,
is that vegetation?
That's vegetation. Cliff.
It's kind of like a ridge. Okay, so that's, excuse me, that's where y'all were. That would have been the north, pretty much the north end of the island.
North end of the island, yeah.
Kind of the north.
I think this must be Airfield number 3, what they were working on.
Okay.
But this letter I've got here, I'm going to give you, it's written by a woman. She goes into detail on a bunch of this.
Okay, okay.
And I think you'll enjoy it. And then this diary at this Japanese Yeah. That'd be something.
Yeah, you'd, y'all you look at that. So what? Describe when you got to the beach. Once you went through all that you went yeah. through, and now you got to the beach. Was that any significance there? Or
well,
what?
They had told us, you know, it's strictly bull, but we'll have a steak for you when you get to the end of the beach.
Okay.
We had no steak. That was just
something to say.
That was just something. No. But the ground was warm there, and we had put our sea ration down that sand, and it heated up for us. Yeah.
Really?
There was a sulfur mine on that.
And yeah, I was going to ask you, could you smell the sulfur
smell?
Oh,
yeah, you could smell it, and it was warm when you laid on it, too. Surely was.
So it was several days, then, for you to get from here all the way across.
36 days
to get probably, what, 3 or 4 miles?
They say it's 8 miles.
8 miles, from where you went across.
They had Easter Sunday services, April the 4th, 1945, that Easter Sunday services there. I wasn't a real, real strong religious person, but Jonathan and I had a little prayer every night. I know it was a kid prayer. And now lay me down to sleep. Pray, Lord, my soul to keep. If I should die before awake, pray, Lord, my soul to take. And I said that every night.
Did you have a military-issued Bible, New Testament, or anything?
I didn't have one of them. No, I didn't have one of them. Got home. No, we left. I got to tell you a sad part about this, too.
Well, how long were you on there after the fighting stopped? How long did you stay on there?
Well, see, we got there on the 20th, and we left on the 4th of April.
Okay.
So we were there.
You did the Easter service, and then you left.
Yeah.
Okay.
And got back to.
So you didn't occupy. Y'all, your mission was to
get it, and then the army came in
and occupied.
And they occupied it, and okay. they still was shooting jabs. Could see they 16 miles of caves down there, and they were still there. In fact, I understand it hadn't been too long ago that two of them came out. Gave up. And this girl, she kind of explained it in her letter. Got back to Guam. And
so that's what y'all did. Y'all left here and went back to Guam.
Yeah.
And then
I got, only time I ever got seasick is when I first got on that first boat right off of Evo. And boy, I got seasick. But anyhow, I got
after all you've been through, then you got seasick, huh?
Got on to Guam and went down to my tent. When we left Guam, we had a 6-man tent, and they had all buddies, and some of them already been in sea through the 2 campaigns. And we had some of them Carlton Raiders, and 2 of them, Rakowski and Winfrey's. John Rakowski and Winfrey's. But let me tell you one on Guam before I get to that. They're kind of cute. We was hunting for some eggs or chickens on Guam. That's before we went to Ebo. And so our little old scout group went out. Sergeant McAvoy was with us, Rakowski, and a few more of them. Anyhow, we heard some banging on some trees out there. And there's Japanese people. I guess they was getting some sort of a fruit. Anyhow, McAvoy said, I'll go get the bar. Well, that bar, Brown on the Mountain Driver. I'll go get the bar. Well, Owen and I, we just stayed there. And there was 8 Japs just walked right up. And we killed 7 of those Japs. I'm not bragging, but it's just part of war. We killed 7 of them. And then one of them started running. And I started running after him. And this is another time that Oney might have saved my life. Anyhow, I started running after that Jap. And Oney hollered at me, "Don't, no, stop, don't," or something, I see. And now he let me know that I shouldn't run after that Jap. Let him get on going in the jungle. And I did. And who knows? But anyhow, the other bad part back when we got back from Evo to Guam, I went down to that tent. I cannot come up with a word how I felt. If you can come up with a word, the deepest that you think you'll ever feel, that's when I felt right there. Jonathan, we had left that island. Guam, it was six men in there. When I walked back down to it, I was the only one left. Lordy, 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 I wished I knew. I'm sorry.
That's okay, that's okay, that's okay.
I'm sorry.
That's all right, it's all right.
I hadn't told a bunch of people this. Maybe one more experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We left there, and then in, let's see, December, said we were going to be home for Christmas. We would. But we got into San Diego on February the 2nd. I called Mother and talked with her. She paid the bill.
Now, when was this, when you were back in San Diego?
San Diego, it was February the 2nd, 1945. No, 46.
46,
yeah.
Okay,
46.
Okay. Go ahead and tell that. I want to ask where you were when you heard about the surrender.
So, oh, good
but,
Lord.
But tell,
I got another story on that. This is not a good story either.
I want you to tell both of them, whichever one you want to tell first.
This is kind of a cute, halfway of a cute story anyhow. We heard about the bombing and the signing of it. Oney didn't drink beer, and W.F. Smith didn't drink beer, and I didn't drink very much. But anyhow, I saved a bunch of beer for some reason or other. And we heard about that, so I started drinking beer that morning. I don't know how
you
many.
You heard about Japan's surrender?
Surrender.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't know how many I drank, but anyhow, finally.
Where were you?
I was on Guam.
Guam still, okay.
And I finally made it over to my cot. And I was drunk, Lord have mercy. And I fell out of my cot on the ground. I stayed there all the rest of the night. I woke up the next morning. But listen, fella, that was a happy part of our life. See, when we got back to Guam from Evo, we started getting ready to hit Kyushu, Japan, which is the southern part of Japan. And our 3rd Regiment, which was made a reserve on Evo, we had the 21st and 9th hit Evo. They kept the 3rd Regiment in reserve for something or other. Anyhow, Howland Smith and General Howland Smith and Graves B. Erskine, they went aboard the flagship and tried to persuade those SCHMITZ. He's the one in charge of the operation. They tried to persuade him to relieve the 3rd because, man, we had lost so many people. And we're getting these little replacements, but the replacements, they wasn't doing much good. But they wouldn't let them. They was destined to hit Kyushu, Japan. But the 21st and the 9th was going to be right by them when we hit Kyushu, Japan. So we had something to celebrate for.
Did you hear about the first atomic bomb dropping?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What was the reaction? What was everybody think about that? I mean, how was it presented? I mean, we know now it was an atomic bomb.
Yeah.
But what? How was it then?
We wanted to drop a bunch more. Tell you what, that was something else. People don't know it.
You were wondering why they just dropped one, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Then, and one of the guys is in Pinecraft down here. He was on the little island there, and he saw the hole where they had the bomb. And he saw when it, Neela Gay, when it coming back, he was there. Oh, good Lord of mercy. So many things happened. So many stories.
And so you heard the news that they were surrendering.
And then they had already signed it. I've got a picture and a video of the signing of it.
So from August to February, the war is pretty much over. You stayed on Guam the whole time?
We were on Guam getting ready to hit Kyushu, Japan.
Yeah, but I mean, once Japan surrendered in August...
We did nothing.
Okay.
Yeah, we just waited there, saying...
September, October, November, December, January.
I know it. Yeah, we was ready to come
just
back.
Just waiting to...
We was ready to come back, you know.
But what did they have you do to keep you occupied?
We played ball. Yeah, we did. We played ball.
Baseball?
Baseball. No, baseball. Primarily.
Okay.
Yeah. And that gave us something to do. Played lots of poker. Didn't have any lights, but we had a candle. We played, you know, penny ante poker there. Something other to do.
Just stay out of trouble, huh?
Yeah.
Keep away from the beer.
Yeah. There's a kid. It was Kel there, and I thought of his name a while ago. Name. You know, that's another bad part of this. When I lost all those boys there in that tent, I tried to quit remembering names, and, you know, that's kind of stuck with me.
Where were they from? What parts of the country?
All over the United States.
Any of them from the South, from any southern
most
states?
One from Mississippi.
Mississippi, okay.
Yeah, what was his name? I don't remember his name. He one boy from Mississippi, yeah.
What kind of backgrounds did some of your closest buddies have in the context of, you know, you grew up in a sawmill logging camp.
Yeah, yeah.
What were some of the other backgrounds? I mean... Talk a little bit about that.
It was various. Those boys from Mississippi, you know, they knew about us. And
they knew about logging camps and that
type of life. In Alabama and Louisiana. And they had one boy from Florida with us. Pennsylvania, New York, and like I mentioned, Vermont. They're just all over the United States.
Yeah.
But you all come together. Burt Westmoreland's that boy's name. He was killed on Evo. And I think about airfield number 2. And he's in my outfit. I didn't know him, but he was a football star. And that whole team, I think, in 1943, when they got out, a bunch of those boys joined the Marines. And he was one of the boys, Burt Westmoreland. Well, it was a bad story on him. I didn't see it, but the boy from Beaumont, he saw him. And there's a mortar or something. He had a piece of tin. That mortar went through that tin and stuck in his stomach. And he was just hollering. But there was under machine gun fire, and so nobody go get him. But eventually, you know, I worked at Texas Power and Light Company. And people come in and talk about their high bills. Anyhow, this Miss Westmoreland, she called in and fussing about her bill, and none of the girls could satisfy her, so they gave her to me. And she told me her name. I said, "Oh Lordy." And we kept on talking about the bill, and I asked her. I said, "Did you have a boy by the name of Bert?" "Yes." "He was in the Marine. He was killed." And I said, "Yeah, he was my outfit." Well, I would not go and talk to her at that time. But then finally, Mabel and I, we just got enough nerve that we went over and talked to her. And I told her the prettiest story that I could think of, see, about how her boy got killed. And, you know, I couldn't tell her the story. It had been too bad, so I just made up a story and told her. And I felt good about that all these years that I did go to one of them and talk to them. But I wished I'd have gone on that other ones too. But I didn't. That behind us.
Talk about, you said when you got back to San Diego, you called your mom.
Called Mom, also called Mabel. And, I think a telephone bill was $15.
Wow. That was a good bit back then, huh?
Well, we had to talk about it. She sounds just like a little Texas girl. I tell you, we got a language down in Texas different from anybody else in the world, I do believe.
So you mentioned Mabel. Y'all were kind of going steady when you were in high school. Were y'all able to write while you were away?
She was my sweetheart.
Were y'all able to write?
We wrote each other, communicated each other all the time. And she kept the letters until I think they was moving. She lost most of the letters. But she did find one, and she let me read it the other day. I don't believe I wrote that letter. No, what you talking about? Mushy? Yeah.
Oh, man. Who is that guy?
That was mushy, mushy, mushy letter.
That had to be somebody else. Huh?
So
what was one of the first things you did when you got back? I mean, how long did you get?
We got back here February the 2nd. They gave us a Gutenberg on a uniform, and they told the boss, said, "Now, y'all be careful now." Said, "They said Gutenberg, and those girls, they're going to get you, and they're going to get all your money anyhow." Got off the plane and going over to the bus station, and there's two beautiful automobile and two girls in there, and they want to know that I want to have a little fun. So I asked,
the reporter's going now.
How much is that fun? I said, well, $20. I said, no. Anyhow, because I knew what they was after. They're after my money. The heck with that. They weren't going to get my money. Anyhow, I went on and got the bus. Took off to Die Ball, and that was such a meeting. And Mabel's mother and I, we were just friends, double friends.
And so they met you getting off the bus at Antlers or or where?
No, they was on the highway, old Die Ball Highway, in their house. It was early in the morning when I got there. And well, it was after daylight, but it was early. And they were still all in bed. You know, you didn't lock your door. So I just opened the door and went in back there and sat down on Estelle's side of the bed. And talked to her and cried with her. And Mabel's the other room. I went to see her mama first. Estelle was a very, very nice mother-in-law. She really was. And then we got February 2nd. Went to Dow Chemical Company, and Uncle Morris got me a real fine job. Pipe fitter. And I'll have to tell you a few things that's not good. I had lots of bad memories of this. So I thought alcohol would take care of it, Jonathan. Alcohol will not take care of anything. Just make it worse, I do believe. But anyhow, I was pretty bad on alcohol. But after marrying Mabel, that was March 16th, we moved to Freeport then. Went down there, and so I quit drinking a lot. Mabel had never been around anybody that drank, nothing like that. No honky-tonks, no nothing. She's a little East Texas girl. And anyhow, a couple of my buddies that I knew at Die Ball, they came down, and so she did go with us to a few of them. And, oh, Lordy. Well, I know we drank way too much. And Womack was there, and my cousin J.L. White came down. And J.L., he drank too much. He told Womack, he said, stop down to the stop sign. Well, Womack knew what that meant. He was getting sick in his stomach. So Kenneth, he stopped the automobile, and J.L. got out, you know, and did a little vomiting. Oh, Lordy. Then I had a good job with Dow Chemical and paid good. Anyhow, I had drank a lot that night. I mixed it up, and they called me out, and I went down and hooked up those big barges. And I was so sick, and I mean I was double sick. I couldn't even go down there, and I said, tell you what, John, this is going to be your last one. So I quit drinking that day for years and years and years. And I just wouldn't drink anymore because it didn't do any good. So I quit it. And then, mother and I came back and, back to, Die Ball and stayed with her parents a little bit. And I worked a little bit for an old lady putting in some, gas lines at Die Ball. And that didn't work too good either. Helped my pa-in-law, he was a mechanic, best one in Angelina County, Harry Nivens. And then we decided to go to college. So we went to Stephen F. Austin. Went over there, 4 semesters, I believe, and didn't get my, see, I didn't get, have too much high school education. Really, I wasn't prepared to go to college. Mr. Pate gave me a certificate that I could go, but I wasn't really prepared to go to college. But mother, she was a valedictorian in the high school, so she helped me a lot some of my books, but it still, it wasn't up here. And see, I never told her anything I've told you here today. I didn't tell her that probably for 40 years, and it was still on my mind. And that probably had part of it, too. I don't know.
What about your grandfather? Did you keep pretty in close touch with him?
Grandfather passed away before I left.
Before you left to go overseas?
Uh-huh. Yeah, he did.
And what about your dad? Did you keep in touch with
him?
Then
I came back and stayed with him just a week or so.
But I mean, was your relationship such with your dad that you ever talked to him about it?
No, didn't tell him a word. Didn't tell any of them anything.
Did he ever ask? Or?
No, didn't. Fatty Landrum, he was there. He come down and.
Did anybody in your family serve during World War One? Did you have anybody in your family that served or anything?
But after that, all three of my brothers went into the service.
Okay.
But they didn't have to see combat. And I didn't tell them anything about it at all.
If you're up to it, I wanted to ask you a few questions about fishing.
All right. But I fish.
But before we get to that, I thought we'd close maybe with that, unless you want to continue on. But I'd like for you to talk a little bit about what it's meant, and you've already done this, but what has it meant to you to be a Marine, you know, all these many years afterwards?
In 89, Jack Warner, I think it was 89, Jack Warner and Gene and I were doing some place, and Jack, you see, he knew I was in the Marines, and he says, did you know that your 3rd Division is an association? And I said, no. He said, yeah. I said, they're having a meeting, this so and so forth. And I said, you ought to call some of them and maybe join that association. So I did, got in association. We went to that reunion that year.
Where was it?
You remember? Seemed like to me it was Wisconsin.
Okay.
And because we'd gone all over the United States. I think it was Wisconsin. And so I met a bunch of them, see, that I had been in the service with. That sergeant that I was telling you about that wouldn't put you, he was there. Hall was there. There's a bunch of boys that I knew. And so it was, and we talked about it. And, you know, we had similar experiences. And it just, it kind of eased off on me. And I enjoyed that reunion so much. And then I started going every year. And I've got to meet some real, real nice people now. Most of them, now I've got a picture of the house of 28 of us, of the 21st Regiment that was left. And so I got a picture of them. And we got down to about 5 or 6, something like that. Then it got down to 3. And I formed the reunion myself. Many reunions. So we just decided we'd just forego that because it just wasn't enough of us. But we, in the meantime, I've joined the Texas chapter of the Third Division Association, and I've got active with that, and some of the boys, we still got two of them in there that was on Evo in that. And so I enjoy getting with them, and also most of them are, you know, Korean and in Vietnam. And those Vietnamese boys, to me, they had a worse time than I did. Washington had set up what's called a rules of engagement. Rules of engagement. It's still going on to this day. They give you a plan one day, say, okay, you can shoot if you're shot at. Next day, you cannot shoot. Next day, it said, you can shoot. It changes all the time. The boys never knew what they was going to get into. Now, my brother-in-law, he had a similar experience I did. He shot his best buddy. And best buddy, he come up into the line and on that noise maker deal, and he shot him, and the next guy in a foxhole shot him, and then he found out that he was his best buddy. And my little brother-in-law, he hadn't got over that yet. He really had. Now, he and I are taking just about the same drugs. And I've doubled up on my drugs trying to help me so I won't just, what do you call it, just, yeah, so it won't bug me too much. Mm-hmm. And I didn't ask you a question, did I?
Well, just what has it meant to have been a Marine and to experience all the many years since then?
It's a camaraderie. I'll guarantee you, if a grenade had fell down here in amongst you, some of those guys were going to jump on top of that grenade to save life, Russell. I never had that experience. It never happened to me as such. And I don't know whether that I had that much nerve to jump on that grenade or not. But that is a camaraderie that we had for each other. We loved each other. That's exactly the way it was. And you'd just do anything in the world for that buddy of yours. That's just how it is. And we were taught one thing. And we're not fly boys. And we're not tank boys. We're not artillery boys. We're boys that was trained to fight. I hate to say that. But we were guys that were trained to fight. We were trained to kill. Just that simple, see. And I've often thought about that boy that I shot. Jonathan, if I had waited just maybe a second or two, that he had exposed more of himself and I could have seen who he was, and I might not pull the trigger, see.
But then if you had waited, but he Jonathan, might have pulled the trigger on you.
I know it, see. That was...
That's just war, isn't it?
That's just war. That's just survival. Lord, I wish I could go over that second again. I'd give anything in the world for good. That's part of it.
Okay, well, if you are up to it, let's move to fishing.
Okay.
Talk about the early days of Sam Rayburn and all that, and when did you get into it? I know you got into it pretty big.
We got into it real, when we moved up to Dallas, or Texas Power and Light Company, hired me in 1948. George and Faye Honey, they had just married and left on their little honeymoon down to New Orleans. He was he run a TSE railroad for Temple.
Mm-hmm.
But I tried to find a job after I went to college. I went all over East Texas, couldn't find a job. So Louise Red, she knew us high school. So she told Mabel that one of their boys quitting worked for TPNL.
Texas Power and Light.
So Texas Power and Light. That was a good company. Yeah, I went down there and applied there. And what I wanted to do was be a lineman. And they didn't have any open, but they did have open for the office. Well, see, I'd gone to school, and I had typing and shorthand and bookkeeping and all like that stuff. So Mr. Horn, Mr. Bob Stroud are going to hire me. So we went in their office there, and they offered me $135 a month. And I told Mr. Stroud, Mr. Horn, I said, I'm married now, and my wife is expecting. And I've already gone to college. Hadn't gotten my degree, but I've gone, and already got the military behind me, and I just don't think we can get by on $135. And they were sincere with me. I said, go out there and have a seat, and we'll call you in a minute. Well, they called Dallas, our personnel department. Must have talked with them, seemed like me, for ages. Anyhow, Mr. Horn come out there and said, come on back in the office, and went in there. And Mr. Strauss said, we've got good news for you. Said, we're going to start you at $137.50. Gosh. Anyhow, that was a job. So, and I loved it. I loved the job. I loved the employees there.
No, it was in Dallas?
Year in Lufkin.
In Lufkin, okay. Lufkin,
yeah. 1948 instead of 55. And they transferred me to Palestine as the chief accountant over there, which is in charge of all your accounting. But it sent me over there as an assistant because they didn't want the news to get out, I guess. Stayed there a while and then began to know people with the company. And so they wanted me to go up to Irvin. 1955, went up there in 56. When we drove through Irvin, got to the other side of Irvin, and old man's on the side of the road, and we stopped and asked him, said, where is Irvin? And he said, you just came through it. That's how small it was.
Nowadays.
But we were gaining so many customers that time, it was just unbelievable. But and then they sent me from Irvin then over to Mesquite, same way. We were gaining 200 to 250 customers every month. And we put in the first gold medallion home unit in Irvin. Well, these Yankees coming down, they had been used to high summer bales. They didn't have any winter bales. They didn't have too much of a summer bale. Didn't have much air conditioning. But anyhow, they started fussing at us, and they was coming down for TI and other places, other companies there in Dallas. So Dale Moore and I, we got it up. Said, we know what I did. So we went and started talking to him. Said, well, tell you what. Remember those high bills you got in the wintertime? You're down here, you're cooling. So you're going to have those high bills in the summertime. That satisfied everybody. Oh, went out on one complaint. These people own Coca-Cola Bottling Company in Lufkin. Lupton was their name, and went out. She had one of those electric heat pumps also, but she had a big old fireplace. What Miss Lupton was doing was she had
Miss what's her name again?
Lupton. Yeah, they own Coca-Cola Company there, and so she had her servants or who worked on it with. They kept a fire in that fireplace going. Well, that electricity was just sucking at them, just right on up. And so we finally persuaded her she needed to cut down her furnace. So she cut down it worked out good. But then we stayed at Mesquite there, and oh, it was wonderful. Got into the Friends Library, became president of that group.
In Mesquite?
In Mesquite, just and worked with the Kiwanis Club for years and years, and got into politics. Roe Hart was running for city council. Well, I knew everyone on the city council, plus the mayor. The mayor and I had gone to a number of towns outside, you know, talking about, you know, town, what so forth. I was just personal friends with all of them. Well, Roe Hart was going to run against.
How do you spell that?
Roe, R-O-W-E, Hart, just Roe Hart. And he was going to run for city council. Well, he and I were fishing buddies. And so he kind of come up there and made TP and held his campaign quarters. And, you know, we couldn't have that. Anyhow, they transferred me from that office to Tyler. Went over to Tyler. I didn't have any job. They gave me an automobile, and I spent most time on a lake down there. But now, we had gone in.
Lake Tyler?
Hey, Lake Tyler.
Yeah, that's a pretty new lake, wasn't it?
Beautiful lake.
Just put in.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, man. I went down and just fish. But we come up with a new computer system, and I got it down real good. So I wrote out a bunch of outlines, what to do and what not to do. And so I started going around to all the districts and presenting that to the employees. And that's about the biggest job I had over at Tyler. Well, I had an opening over here at Fairfield. Put in a new lignite plant. They need a purchasing agent. And purchasing agent job paid pretty good. So Vice President Weatherby, he came over, and Weatherby was one of my buddies, too. He was one of the VPs. We went over to Fairfield and talked to him and all. Well, they already had two Texas Power and Light Company employees over there. They had one Texas Electric employee over there. But I just thought, you know, I'd just go over and I'd get that job just real relieved because I had a new lake. It'd be a place for me to fish.
Power plant lake?
Yeah, yeah. Power plant lake. Anyhow, turned out that they had too many Texas Power and Light Company employees at that plant. He said, okay, we wanted to get one out of Texas Electric, which is Fort Worth. We had three companies together. So he got the job, and so I just stayed here at Lufkin. And Ray Horn, he got ready to retire, and it was just an open job for me. So they gave me this job here at Lufkin, and I was in charge of all the accounting and the meter reading and collecting and storeroom and you name it. Anything had money to do it, that was my responsibility. Had a big title of, manager of production. And by that time, they had started paying pretty good salary, I'd say. And that helped a great deal, especially in my latter years. But, Lord, I got to know these industrial customers here at Lufkin real good. Paper mill, the foundry, Lufkin Industries, and I loved the job, really did. Good company. And then I started fishing about 1970 when we got here. Joined Lufkin Bass Club. We had about 100 members, and that's a bunch of people. Anyhow, we met down there at our little office, well, at our conference room. TPNL, and so naturally I could get that for him. That's where we met. So I started competition fishing, and I fished with all of them, like Dr. Shelton and, well, all the bunch. End up, I probably got 150 trophies of bass fishing. Money-wise, Lord, it's no telling how much money I spent on fishing equipment. My fishing room was larger than this right here. I bet you I had over $100,000 worth of fishing equipment. That's not included boat. That's just fishing equipment. Lord, I loved it, and I shouldn't have gone that much. I shouldn't have gone that much. But I loved everything, and I met so many good people. And we had our state tournaments, all top six, what they call them. And we'd meet on these, let's say, like Amstead or Lake Falcon or Rayburn or Toledo Bend. We met all over.
So you traveled around.
We traveled around all over the country.
You were serious.
I was very, very serious. And we'd go and stay in his hotel room. Bill Shelton, his secretary, she kept up a record of hotel and so forth. So when we're going to go someplace, well, she'd go ahead and make a reservation for us. So we didn't have a problem doing that. We went, checked in.
Were there limits when you were fishing in the early 70s? Were there limits?
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. You had a 10 limit.
10 limits, not yeah. 5, but 10.
Yeah, okay. 10 limits.
And did the fish have to be alive to weigh them in? When did that start?
Later on.
Okay.
Yeah, later on. We put on a number of tournaments ourselves, and we really criticized down at, where was that? Pendleton. No. Cedar Bend. And there's a bunch of people. There's a top six members from all over the state came up there. And there was a bunch of our fish died. And there's some article, a newspaper man, so he gave us a real, real bad report. Us, you know.
Basically killing all the fish.
Yeah. Well, really just part of it. And but now then, they want you to keep those fish alive. And if they're not alive, well, they penalize you for bringing in a dead fish.
Right. And you have to release them alive.
You have to release them
alive. Yeah.
And we did. And we, the Texas Park and Wildlife Department, they got in these Florida bass. Okay. We bought the netting. Our club did. We bought the netting. And they released them and we put the net out so the other fish couldn't get them. And so we helped start the Florida bass here in Sam Rayburn. Now, that's been years ago.
Years ago, yeah.
Yeah.
But talk about how the lake changed during the years that you fished. You know, it was impounded in the mid-late 60s. And
we had all those stumps every place.
A lot of standing timber.
Lots of standing timber, see. And I don't know how many boats I owned, but I knocked holes in every one of them. I think every insurance company here in Lufkin canceled out on me. I'm not kidding you. I'd call them. I said, I got a hole. Even my little son-in-law, Bill Bartlett, he married my number two daughter. They finally got a divorce. But he adopted my grandson, my grandkids, and they just still love Bill, just that. But here's the Bartlett Bay and Sand. They even canceled my insurance company. But kinfolks.
Kinfolks canceled.
Yeah. Then I got in with Greg Gibbs and Toledo Fiberglass, the boy over there, Al, something. He came up with some sort of a deal. He put on a body of boat, what's called a gorilla hull. Later on, they started putting in the beds pickup trucks. It's almost just indestructible. But anyhow, I've got a lifetime guarantee on my hull. And so I didn't have any more holes knocked in. So Gibbs, he's had it all the time, made money on me. Goodness gracious.
Talk about how fishing techniques for bass have changed during that time.
It has changed considerable. See, before we did not have any plastic baits to use. That came up, that revolutionized, because I had most of the topwater suspenders. But that worm, boy, I mean, it gets
the soft plastic worm.
The plastic worm. And they do love it. And most of your big tournaments are won using that plastic worm or either a jig. Jig is good, too. Jig was real, real good in Falcon. And just push it down there. And you can tell when that old bass gets hold of that jig just a little bit, see. Then you got to set it.
Did you fish long enough into all the line technologies like fluorocarbon and
You a dozen different lines in my tackle box.
How recently have you fished?
We fished a year before. See, I've had lots of heart problems.
Right, right.
Yeah. And
but I mean, so you have fished with fluorocarbon? Have you fished with that line? Okay.
Yeah.
What's your favorite line? I'm just curious.
I guess that would be probably the better line. It's the most expensive line, anyhow. but it's very sensitive too.
Yeah, it doesn't stretch as
That's
much,
right.
supposedly.
Yeah, it doesn't stretch. And then they come up with this.
Because I don't see how y'all set hooks on jigs on those bass with those little old bitty pistol grip 5.5 foot rods. You know, nowadays, the longest one I have is 7, but there's some guys that's got 8 foot long rods.
I know it.
65 pound braid.
That's right.
And they're jerking the jaws out of those fish.
I have
How'd y'all do it with those stretchy monofilament?
I have still got one rod and reel, got 80 pound test. That braided line. You know, you straighten your hooks out, you're not going to break that line. No way. But you know what? I don't think I've caught a lot of fish on an 80-pound test line.
No, I use 50 at the heaviest.
Yeah.
30
80,
a lot.
80 is high,
But how did y'all do it with stretchy monofilaments?
I'm sure
y'all missed a lot of fish.
We've missed lots of fish. But try to take that slack out as much as you could. See,
well, and just, you got low ratio reels back then, too. You know,
now then they come up 4, 5, 6.
8 to 1
now. Yeah. Gosh, see.
Most of mine are 7, 7 to 1. But, I mean, 4 to 1 was fast back then.
Fast. But lots of people still using that 4. They like it.
Yeah, and, I think for crankbaits and stuff to slow down the tree.
Yeah. But Bill and I and Otto Smith and I go out to all these little towns around and see how many baits they had. And instead of just buying one or two, we just...
You'd stock up, huh?
We just buy all of them. And that was unnecessary.
Now, what did Mabel... How did she deal
She just took it fine.
She never complained?
She never complained.
Never?
Never.
Uh-uh. Never went on a spending spree herself?
Well, she might have had. But she went with me a few times at various, because she didn't like fishing
either.
She
didn't like it,
But they formed a boys and girls club here, see. He hasn't heard of it.
Hasn't heard of Bass Club?
Yeah.
Did she join that? No.
She went with me one time.
One time.
And then my daughter went with me one time.
She might have gone with you more if you let her catch a few fish.
Well,
did you hog the front of the boat?
No. I've found fish and give her a bait, worm mostly, go up there and she's never get no fun out of it. Same line. But our little daughter, she won her a trophy. She still got that trophy. When I had my garage sale, getting ready to go to Pinecrest, I put a lot of stuff out there to sell, but on my fishing gear, I gave it to my grandson, my rod, my boat and all, and he's going to put it on eBay and see what he set it for. Because I got some old real Calcutta reel. I got one weight that cost $495. Now, brother gave it to me. It's got 13 darn, jewels in it. 13 of them. I have never let anybody else use that except myself. Make sure.
Nobody drops it.
But man, that thing just throws like a jewel. Goodness gracious. But he got all my baits up there to sell. Moved out home, I kind of lost a lot of my, freedoms. We had a will made out. So we looked at that reel, and I had a big safe full of guns. And so we went down to each one of them that had a will. And so we gave them that gun. And then I also had thousands of rounds of ammunition that I bought during Obama came along. And, cause, we didn't know what was going to happen.
So you had an arsenal, didn't you?
I had an arsenal, exactly what I had. So I gave all the kids and all the ammo that went with that particular gun. And I kept one for, it's a .22-250. My brother-in-law, he was on the team, a rifle team for the Marines. He is a good shot, knows all about rifles and so forth. But we found two Remingtons, .22-250 boat, and the one I have got, it's called a nail. Anyhow, you hit it, next time you pull a trigger, it'll hit in that hole. It's just that accurate. that barrel what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And old Bill, he'd love to have that so bad. He bought it for me, but he bought another one with a super deal. It's just a little bit prettier than mine, but mine would shoot better than his.
More accurate, huh?
But I kept it, and I killed a little old deer down there today.
Yeah, I heard you talking about that.
Carried Damascus gills.
A 22-250 is a pretty flat shooting gun.
It's a flat shooting gun. That's right. What you need to do when they come up is try to wave, holler at them or whistle at them, something else. So they look at you. That little white spot in the neck, just shoot at that white spot. They don't go in place.
It doesn't make a big hole, though, does it?
They don't go in place, though. They just sit down right there.
I remember my grandfather always hunted with a .30-06, and
about
25-30 years ago, he bought a .22-250, and I guess he wasn't hitting them in the right place, but we had a hard time finding them at times.
Yeah, you don't supposed to hit them here.
Yeah,
you need to hit them right in that neck.
Okay, yeah, he'd just shoot them in the,
yeah,
in the chest and the heart, but they didn't leave much blood.
I've got that .30-06. I have a Springfield 1903. I was smoking at that particular time in 63. Boyd Brownwood, he made rifles. And so I made up a little contract with him. He'd make me one. So he got a beautiful stock. an excellent barrel. And use that lever action deal there and a good scope on it. Got a It's AccuTrack scope.
Hmm.
And I'll guarantee I have shot deer up in Wyoming 450 yards just real, real easy. I mean, knock them down.
In Wyoming?
In Wyoming, yeah.
Wow.
And, that 30-06 will get them. And I usually try to shoot them in the neck, too, but sometimes it didn't work out that way. It would. But I gave that to my little daughter. She kept it. And I had an M1. With 280 rounds of ammo that was in the clips. That's unusual. But this was just a regular ammo box, metal box. And I had a full box, plus a bunch more, 30-06. But, that M1 will shoot.
Yeah, my dad got my grandfather's M1 from when he was in World War II.
Yeah.
And
it doesn't kick that much. I guess all that weight to it.
Well, it's a pretty small cartridge, isn't it?
It is.
I was surprised that y'all had that for sniper service.
Yeah, 30-06.
That's well, no, you shot 30-06 or the 30, just the 30 M1. Your M1 was in 30-06.
Yeah, M1's 30-06 also.
Okay.
Yeah, sure was.
Okay, all right. Because see, my grandfather's is just the old 30.
Yeah.
Not the 30-06.
Yeah.
Okay. But you had a 30-06
M1.
Okay. Okay. That clarifies what you were saying earlier. Okay.
I didn't tell you this, but we had a 1,000-yard range there at Green's Farm area. And my buddy, Spotter, we'd go down there lots of times and shoot at that 1,000-yard range. And you got this real good spotting scope behind. If you look close enough, you can see that bullet going through the air, kind of make a little waves, a little heat wave. You can see that bullet going through the air.
Wow.
People kind of thought, well, you can see it, because I have.
Wow.
But,
and your eyes are still pretty good, aren't they?
Well, I've got some fancy lens.
You got contact lenses?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here looking through trifocals. My eyes have gone terrible the last few years.
These what they call crystal lens. Cost me $2,000 each.
Wow.
But I can still see pretty good.
Yeah.
And I can read like this.
Yeah.
But my distance is getting a little bit bad.
Okay.
But I had a pair of glasses made like you have. And I use those for a distance.
Yeah.
It's better.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Powers, I appreciate it very much, you doing
Thank
this
you.
Interview.
Thank you.
And
appreciate you asking.
Okay. Well, I'll go ahead and end the interview then, and we'll just stop this.